Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, January 3rd, 2018. We begin today with the Triangulator. 18 things we want in 2018. For most of us, 2017 was a full-on dumpster fire of a year, long and exhausting and infuriating and chaotic and oftentimes simply depressing. So as we embark upon another revolution around the sun, we here at the Indy wanted to lay out something of a wish list for 2018. 18 things we'd like to see happen in our community and our world. Want to add your own personal resolution? Email us back at backtalk@theindyweek.com. Here is their list. Number 1. The impeachment and or prosecution and or utter humiliation of Donald Trump and all of his cronies. 2. General Assembly Republicans to lose their supermajorities. Number 3. North Carolina to privatize liquor sales and relax its restrictions on craft brewers, that is, treat its citizens like grown-ups. 4. More late-night food options across the triangle. Number 5. A conversation, at the very least, about medical and or recreational marijuana and North Carolina to repeal its laws blocking judges from waiving fines and court costs for poor people. That was number 6. Number 7, the legislature to actually fund its class size mandate. Number 8, Wake County Commission to fully fund the Board of Education's budget request. Number 9, Raleigh to figure out what it's doing with Airbnb. Number 10, Raleigh to figure out that backyard cottages aren't really a big deal. Number 11, Durham to embrace tiny homes as a part of its solution to affordable housing. Number 12, Durham to use the Bull City Connector to help lower-income East Durham communities. Number 13, someone to tear down Silent Sam. Number 14, no more music festivals in September. Number 15, more stability for local theater and dance venues and a more diverse pool of arts grant recipients. Number 16, more art house cinemas and outlets or local and independent filmmakers. Number 17, Rhapsody to win the Grammy for Best Rap Album. And number 18, a UNC-Duke Final Four game. Turning to the news section, Thomas Farr, Jesse Helms, and the return of the segregationists. In the fall of 1983, Jesse Helms needed something like political salvation. The veteran Dixie senator faced an uphill re-election campaign against Jim Hunt, the popular two-term governor, Democratic governor. Hunt, framing the 84-60 election as an opportunity for the state to solidify its identity as a tolerant outpost. He was outperforming Helms at the polls, and by October, the conservative firebrand was trailing Hunt by 20 percentage points. Then Helms made a consequential decision. When a bill to make Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday a national holiday easily cleared the House, Helms launched a filibuster against the proposal in the Senate, accusing the slain civil rights icon of embracing action-oriented Marxism. The senator's colleagues were wary of this crusade. Even Strom Thurmond voted for the bill. But Helms was astute enough to recognize that the voters he was courting did not care about the limits of acceptable Capitol Hill discourse. As the New York Times explained, Mr. Helms said his opposition to the King holiday would never hurt him politically in North Carolina because, "I'm not going to get any black votes, period." A Republican political strategist added that in Senator Helms' campaign, the groups he was playing to would probably applaud his stand. Helms' instinct was spot on. He knew that his filibuster wouldn't go anywhere. Even President Ronald Reagan had signaled his intent to sign off on the holiday. But it was the excessive pageantry, the barrage of headlines pitting Helms against communists and liberal softies that galvanized white voters. By December, the polls showed Hunt's lead over Helms had been cut in half. Helms then kicked off a campaign that exploited racial tensions, stoking fears over black voter registration, and publishing campaign literature with headlines such as, "Black voter registration rises sharply," and "Hunt urges more minority registration," and alongside the photos of Hunt with Jesse Jackson. On the eve of the election, Helms accused Hunt of being supported by homosexuals, the labor union bosses, and the crooks, and said he feared a large block vote. The Washington Post reported, asked what he meant, Helms responded candidly, "The black vote." A strategy earned dividend. Though Helms may have lost in Washington's court of opinion, he won in North Carolina, 52% to 48%. The lesson? Never underestimate the dog whistle. It's been more than three decades since Helms' come-from-behind win over Hunt, and nearly 10 years since Helms died. But an examination of the traces he left makes plain what Priddies call his core identity, a politician who had few scruples about inflaming racial resentment for his own political gain. And it's precisely within that context that we should focus on Donald Trump's pick for the Eastern District Court of North Carolina, Thomas Farr, a Raleigh attorney who could soon wind up ruling on issues of grave importance to the African-American community. Farr served as the legal counsel on Helms' 1984 and 1990 Senate campaigns, both of which sought to suppress the African-American vote through intimidating postcard mailing campaigns. More recently, Farr defended the General Assembly's voter ID law, which the Fourth Circuit Court determined targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision. He also defended the legislature's 2011 legislative districts, which had to be redrawn after a lower court struck down 28 of them as illegal racial gerrymanders. And throughout his career, he's aligned himself with North Carolina politicians whose policies have taken aim at communities of color. As the Reverend William Barber, the former head of the state NAACP, put it in a New York Times op-ed on December 26th, Farr is a product of the modern white supremacist machine that Mr. Helms pioneered. When Donald Trump took the oath of office, he inherited an exceptionally high number of judicial vacancies, thanks in no small part to the Senate's blockade of President Obama's nominations in the final year of his presidency. Trump was given the rare opportunity to make the judicial in the Republican mold. To date, he selected the least divisive judicial pool in decades. Among Trump's picks is Farr, whose nomination, which cleared the Senate Judiciary Committee on party-line vote in October, is on hold until the Senate reconvenes this month. Because of his work for Helms and his defense of the legislature's voter suppression efforts, Farr remains one of Trump's most controversial choices. The criticism is extended beyond ideology. The Republicans on the Judiciary Committee were all aware of civil rights advocates' concern and voted for Farr anyway. Instead, the key issue now, and the one that could imperil Farr's lifetime appointment, is whether Farr had misled senators about his work with Helms. Civil rights groups and Democratic politicians are demanding that Farr return to the Judiciary Committee to answer questions first raised by the Indy in November about a controversial 1990 mailing by the Helms campaign consisting of more than 100,000 postcards that a federal court determined were intended to suppress voting by African Americans. In a written response to Senator Dianne Feinstein, Farr said that he did not know about the mailing until after the postcards were out and the Department of Justice intervened. But a former Department of Justice civil rights attorney who worked on the case, Gerald Hubert, has disputed Farr's version of the events, telling the Indy that Farr absolutely was in a meeting at which ballot security, that is, the postcard initiative, was discussed. In light of the Indy's reporting, Senator Cory Booker, a New Jersey Democrat, has asked the Justice Department to provide an internal document known as a J memo, which could clarify Farr's role in the postcard campaign. As a publication, the details of the memo have not been made public. Because Farr's nomination didn't make it to the Senate floor by 2017, the chamber effectively punted it back to the White House. If he chooses, Trump can again nominate Farr. The president has been mum on the subject, and Farr could potentially have a second and presumably more contentious hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. When Jesse Helms first won election to the U.S. Senate in 1972, his voice and face had been familiar to North Carolinians for more than 20 years as a political advocate, journalist, and television editorialist. His rhetoric often served to drive a wedge between white and black people. Throughout his three decades in public service, Helms continued to express these same sorts of racial attitudes. He has built a powerful political and financial empire with bright young men like Farr to keep it running. Helms' attitudes, expressed with the thinnest disguise, or no disguise, unleashed strains of racism that many Southerners thought had been quelled by the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and 65. Under those laws, black people could exercise the same right to vote and eat at the same restaurants as white people. Didn't that mean that we were all going to live together in respect and peace? Into that crystalline vision came Helms, with a history of making clear that while he might hire and tolerate individual African Americans, he largely viewed the black community with contempt. In 2001, the New York Times collected some of the head-turning comments that Helms made about people of color and gays and lesbians. One example from 1963, quote, "The Negro cannot count forever on the kind of restraint that has thus kept him free to clog the streets, disrupt traffic and commerce, and interfere with other men's rights," end quote. In 1993, after black Democratic Senator Carol Moseley Braun debated Helms over the Confederate flag on the Senate floor, Helms joined her in the elevator, started singing Dixie, and told another senator, "I'm going to keep singing Dixie until she cries." Responding to Booker in December, Farr said that he only represented Helms because he joined a law firm that already did Helms' work, not because he believed in Helms' racial views. "I am completely opposed to using race to divide people. I have never done anything in my life to use race to divide people." Helms stoutly resisted the racist label, referring often to the many home state African Americans with whom he had good relations. A partner in Farr's firm was key Helms aide Tom Ellis, who introduced Farr to a political machine that was already cranking hard. Ellis had been scrutinized for serving in the 1970s as an official of the Pioneer Fund, a group that funded research designed to prove that blacks were inferior to whites. In July 1983, the year Farr joined the firm, Ellis's nomination for a seat on the Board of International Broadcasting was scrutinized by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee over his past racist remarks and actions, ultimately derailing his nomination. Ellis's rejection didn't stop Helms or the Congressional Club, a fundraising arm of the campaign that took to millions for the 1984 race. It's possible to trace the Citizens United emboldened money raisers back to the Helms organization, which used a for-profit arm to lend money to favored politicians that several never paid back. While they don't often boast about it these days, some of the Republican Party's most skilled operatives worked during the 80s and 90s for Helms. The storied White Hands ad, portraying a white worker who lost his job to a minority applicant because of quotas, was the work of Alex Castellanos, who went on to work for the Republicans like Senator John McCain, and to become a familiar voice for CNN. Top-level GOP politicals Dick Morris, Charlie Black, and Mark and Karen Roderman were also on the Helms team, according to accounts in the Weekly Standard and the National Journal's hotline. Carter Wren, a longtime Helms hand and a staunch Farr ally, has conceded that the White Hands ad, which helped Helms defeat Harvey Gantt, the African-American former Charlotte mayor, was racist, telling NPR in 2012 that it was absolutely a racist ad. That was the race card. I've been in the room where we played racist politics. We played the race card, and I'm not proud of it. When Helms announced his retirement for the Senate in 2001, the think tank pieces came far and wide. The Washington Post's David S. Broder called on the press to ditch superlatives about the senator's conservative firebrand politics and instead call him what he really was, the last prominent, unabashed, white, racist politician in this country, a title that the one hopes will now be permanently retired. Instead, Helms' policies seem poised for a Trump-era revival, and Farr presents a direct link to the man who filibustered the renewal of the Voting Rights Act, supporting the South African apartheid regime. He introduced legislation to end affirmative action programs and launched two consecutive Senate campaigns that made use of ballot security voter suppression initiatives. More recently, Farr has twice defended, unsuccessfully, the General Assembly's legislative disaster districts and voter ID law, two initiatives widely acknowledged as targeting black voters. Farr has always denied having a racially biased agenda, and he's never exhibited the sort of racially explicit lip-curling jeer that decades of North Carolinians heard from Helms. But Farr's legacy could be equally consequential. He could soon be named a judge for life. The 44-acre area of the Eastern District Court of North Carolina includes 7 counties with state's highest concentration of African Americans: Bertie, Hertford, Northampton, Edgecombe, Halifax, Warren, and Vance. And yet, in spite of the demographics, the district has never had a black federal judge, primarily because Senator Richard Burr blocked 2 African-American women from President Obama's nominations for that seat. In the end, a judge with Farr's record would be ideally placed to reinforce the kind of policies and laws put in place by his former clients in the General Assembly. More than that, though, his full-throated endorsement by Burr, Senator Tom Tillis, and other prominent Republicans is an active embrace of Helms' divisive legacy in the age of no less division Donald Trump. Helm's legacy is not to be sanitized, nor should it be forgotten. Indeed, it never really left. Thomas Farr's involvement in Senator Jesse Helm's ballot security program lasted longer and ran far deeper than was previously recognized, according to federal filings, contemporary coverage, and recent interviews. Today, the Raleigh attorney faces accusations that he knew more about the ballot security effort on behalf of the 1990 Helms campaign, specifically a postcard campaign that sought to intimidate black voters, than he made clear when answering written questions from Senator Dianne Feinstein, a California Democrat and ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. The committee will have the responsibility of once again voting up or down on Farr's nomination after approving it in October if President Donald Trump decides again to nominate Farr for the Federal District Court in Eastern North Carolina. A look at his record shows that if Farr didn't realize the implication of the Helms campaign initiative in 1990, he was ignoring a history of ballot security efforts that he himself had practiced and that were widely known in the GOP circles well before then. For example, in 1981, return GOP mailings to black and Hispanic voters in New Jersey were used to challenge their ballots. They brought about a federal lawsuit filed by the Democratic Party against the Republican National Committee, which had settled with the GOP promise not to use voter intimidation tactics. Farr was not involved in the New Jersey effort, but it seems almost certain he would have been aware of it as a young Republican lawyer. According to Farr's own account, as well as that of Gerald Hubert, a Department of Justice attorney for 21 years, Farr oversaw a ballot security effort in Helms' 1984 campaign against Governor Jim Hunt. That effort reportedly used a similar scheme to, as the Hunt campaign alleged to the Philadelphia Inquirer, blunt the black turnout. As the Inquirer reported, a bulk rate mailing of Helms' campaign postcards was addressed to registered Democrats. The cards, which cost 11 cents to mail, carried a notation to the post service requesting that they be returned rather than forwarded, paying 25 cents a card for each card returned. The Helms campaign is believed to have compiled a list of voters open to challenge at the polling place because they may no longer live at their registered address. In Farr's response to a letter from Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, who is not on the Judiciary Committee, seeking more information about his work for Helms, Farr wrote, "There were no complaints about the illegality of the 1984 mailings." It's far from clear that no one objected. In fact, the next year, the General Assembly passed a law prohibiting same-day electoral challenges based on returned mail. In his letter to Farr, Booker asked whether Farr, as was stated in a 1992 civil rights complaint filed by the Justice Department in response to the 1990 postcard initiative, was the attorney involved in the campaign's ballot security efforts. "I do not know, but several weeks before the election, I participated in a short meeting with persons who wanted to be hired to do ballot security program for the Helms campaign in 1990. That was Farr's reply. He went on, "During that meeting, I told them there was no reason to do a card mailing in 1990 because North Carolina law had been changed and returned cards could not be used to challenge voters." Farr has said he had no advance knowledge of the contents of postcards sent to more than 100,000 North Carolina voters, many of them black. The cards, according to the 1992 complaint, were designed to intimidate and discourage black voters in the U.S. Senate race between the Helms and the former Charlotte mayor, Harry Gant, was involved in that election. But by Farr's own account, He didn't try to dissuade those in that meeting from sending out the mailing. Indeed, he offered advice about how the cards might still be used. "I told them they might attempt to use returned cards in a recount," he wrote to Booker. "However, at the time of this meeting, I was doubtful of the utility of any card mailing, even in a recount, because of the change in North Carolina law." Farr, legal counsel to the campaign, walked away at that point, leaving the mailing in the hands of Ed Locke, a political operative who had worked on the 1984 campaign. This, according to Farr's statement, and a consent decree signed in 1992. Efforts to reach Locke were not successful. Longtime Helms aide Carter Wren told the Indy in November that he was at fault for sending out the postcards, which falsely informed voters who had moved that they were ineligible without reading it. In this scenario, Farr and Wren, both seasoned politicals who had worked for Helms for years, made no effort to stop or even examine a racially targeted mailing that someone, presumably Locke, had designed to give Helms a leg up in the tight race. Under the 1992 consensus decree, which Farr signed for the campaign, the Helms crew admitted no wrongdoing, but were barred from practicing certain techniques while assuring ballot security. The campaign and its associates were also prohibited from any program designed to intimidate, threaten, coerce, deter, or otherwise interfere with a qualified voter's exercise of his franchise. The next news article. A new program is shedding light on why Durham County has such a high eviction problem. On a Thursday morning, 3 days after Christmas, the eviction court on the third floor of the Durham County Courthouse was quiet. Of the more than 40 tenants on the day's docket, just five had come to make their case in front of the magistrate, Amaniah Thompson. Anywhere here from 501 Towns, Copper Hill, Hardy Terrace, Century Treasury Estates, Bell West End, Arion Pinnacle Ridge, Phillips Research Park, Falls Point at the Park, Campus Crossing? Thompson asked. A young woman walked to the front of the small courtroom. She recently got a new job, but her paycheck came too late to make rent, she explained. Of all the other tenants who appeared that morning, she did not have a lawyer. The same two lawyers, however, represented all the apartment complexes called throughout that morning. This has been common in Thompson's 9 years as magistrate. The crowd, however, varies day to day. Durham County, after all, has the highest eviction filing rate of the state's 10 largest counties. The stories vary also, says Thompson, who moved to Durham in 1999. Some are heartbreaking, like a woman in court Thursday who has been getting help from her father since being out of work. But his generosity is finite, she explained throughout tears. My dad is willing to help me pay because he doesn't want me and my daughters out in the street, she said. Other stories boil down to poor budgeting. The number of summary ejection filings has been falling in Durham County. Despite the addition of more than 30,000 residents from just over 14,000 in fiscal year 2010 to 17,134 in fiscal year 2016. But the county has maintained the highest eviction rating filing. Last fiscal year, one eviction case was filed per 29 residents. And while this figure may include multiple filings against the same tenant, it is also likely leaves out illegal evictions that don't involve the court system. This all raises the question, what's different about Durham? It's an answer to the evictions diversion program launched in August by Duke University's Civil Justice Clinic, Legal Aid of North Carolina, and the Durham County Department of Social Services is trying to uncover. Although it's too early to say whether the program is achieving its goal of reducing the number of eviction cases filed, it's beginning to fill out the picture of who is being evicted, where evictions are occurring, and why. When people are paying more than 50% of their income in rent, it doesn't take much to disrupt their monthly budget to the point where they can't pay their rent on time, says Peter Gilbert, one of two legal aid attorneys who handle the bulk of the eviction cases that come through the program. The Eviction Diversion Program connects tenants to legal and financial help to avoid evictions and the costs associated with them. Whenever a summons for an eviction case goes out, a flyer about the program is included. Tenants call county social services, which can determine whether they qualify for rental assistance, and then get referred to legal aid if necessary. In most cases, Gilbert says, an attorney is able to reach settlement with the landlord, buying tenants more time in their homes or avoiding displacement. A map by DataWorks North Carolina of filings from 2012 to 16 show clusters of eviction cases along major corridors with a lot of apartment complexes like 15501 and NC55, but also in neighborhoods ringing downtown that have all of some of the city's highest poverty rates. The eviction map. Although the number of eviction filings in Durham County has been decreasing since 2010, the county has maintained the highest eviction filing of the state's 10 largest counties. The map that was included in this paper article shows the number of summary complaints, a legal action filed by the landlord seeking to evict a tenant, filed in Durham County from 2012 to 2016. One of the indicators denoted census block groups with more filings. If a summary injection is granted and the tenant hasn't already moved out or reached a deal with his or her landlord to stay, a landlord can then seek a writ of possession to have the tenant removed. What we have is a wealth distribution issue, says City Councilmember Jillian Johnson. We have a growing affordability crisis that is leading to an eviction crisis, and that inevitably leads, without intervention, to a homelessness crisis. The issue was caught the attention of the Durham Human Relations Commissions, whose members have been sitting on eviction court proceedings to learn more about the process and the people affected by it, and the City Council. While the city already has funds, rapid rehousing programs, Johnson said, she'd like to see the city help pay for attorneys to represent tenants in court. Online records from the Administrative Office of the Courts only detail summary injection filings going back to fiscal year 2010, so it's difficult to say just how long evictions have been a problem in Durham. But across the county, evictions rose amid the recessions that ended in 2009. Thompson says that when she started hearing eviction cases, tenants were paying $300 to $500 a month. Now they're paying upward of $1,000. Tenants with relatively low rents are showing up in court more often, she said. They recognize that if they get evicted, they're not going to be able to find something else, she said. Last fiscal year, Durham County saw an average of 859 summary ejectment filings each month. After a landlord issues a notice, for example, for late rent, he or she can file a summary ejection complaint and ask a judge to grant the eviction. Evictions were granted in about half of the cases filed last fiscal year. At that point, an eviction can appear on a tenant's rental or credit history, even if a settlement with the landlord is reached. Fewer cases result in writs of possession, which allow the Durham County Sheriff to remove a person being evicted. According to the Sheriff's Office, deputies padlocked 1,875 units in 2016. I was surprised at the number of cases that are resulting in judgments and not in being displaced from their homes that month, Gilbert said. In some ways it's better, but really, it's just speaking to a different problem. Currently, social services only refers to people to the diversion program who already have a notice to appear in court, about 50 cases per month. That doesn't leave a lot of time to prepare. Ultimately, the goal is to get involved in cases earlier so attorneys can learn more about each individual's housing and financial situation and try to avoid a judgment. I think people assume that if they come to small claims court and present a sad story, that's going to help them, says Jesse McCoy with Duke Civil Justice Clinic. It doesn't work that way. There are four attorneys working in various capacities for the program, plus about 10 Duke Law students. While they are bilingual people at Legal Aid and the Civil Justice Clinic, the Eviction Diversion Program does not have a bilingual attorney. Gilbert estimates that the program needs another attorney and paralegal to help everyone currently seeking help from the program, not to mention those going to social services for assistance before an eviction is filed. 10 to 15 tenants each month can't be helped because of the program's capacity, and approximately 15 more can't be contacted by attorneys. To reach more people sooner, the program is hosting clinics each Wednesday on the second floor of the county courthouse. The program is also setting up a phone line so tenants can contact it directly. Any increase in reach requires an increase in resources. Charles Holton, director of the Civil Justice Clinic, says the program is looking for partners to help people who need financial assistance but can't get it from social services. Duke students will also study what role gentrification has played. There are bigger issues that I think one program alone may not necessarily be able to fulfill, McCoy says. We've historically neglected the impact of affordable housing in Durham. I think it's telling that we can't really put a definition on what we consider to be affordable housing locally. Turning to the next news article. A republic, if you can keep it. A resolution in the age of Donald Trump. There's a famous anecdote, possibly apocryphal, about the time Benjamin Franklin, when leaving the Constitutional Convention of 1787, was approached by a woman asking what kind of government the clandestine gathering had produced. A republic, Franklin is said to have replied, if you can keep it. I've been thinking about that line and the idea behind it a lot lately. As we stand at the precipice of another new year and look in the rear view at an unsettling 2017, there's an undeniable fragility to this moment, a sense that the country is ripping itself asunder. Sure, there's Donald Trump, a corporeal incarnation of narcissism, self-delusion, mendacity, and graft, helped into office by white nationalists and a meddling foreign government. But it's more than that. It's also the widening gap between rich and poor. U.S. income inequality ranks among the highest in the developed world, and a Social Security net that is threatened while the healthiest are showered with tax benefits, a parallel of sorts to the waning days of the ancient regime. There are the increasingly authoritarian proclivities of the ruling party and its leader. There are naked gerrymanders that render urban minority votes less meaningful than rural white ones. And for that matter, there's the U.S. Senate, where two-thirds of the country's population will be represented by less than one-third of the senators by 2040, as more people migrate to the biggest states. There's a self-segregation of social media, amplifying enmity and reinforcing beliefs we've already hold, whatever the reality. There's a rise of the alt-right, and there's a zero-sum mentality permeating our politics. None of this bodes well, considering that this anxious undercurrent exists amid a growing economy that has added jobs every month for almost 8 years. Imagine what happens when that inevitability goes south. The rear view of 2017 is again unsettling. But America has survived a lot over the last 23 decades. Two world wars, one civil war, the Great Depression, the Cold War, and the Republic will also survive Donald Trump. But only if we can keep it. The brevity of Franklin's response, the late historian Richard Beeman once wrote, should not cause us to undervalue its essential meaning. Democratic republics are not merely founded upon the consent of the people, they also absolutely are dependent upon the active and informed involvement of the people for their continued good health. What Franklin was saying 230 years ago was that the republic can only be maintained with perpetual vigilance, lest it devolve into despotism. The first year of the Trump administration has only underlined this point. The second year of the Trump administration will be no different. It's up to us to resist the White House's racial vagacism. It's up to us to counter fiction with fact, to demand reality-based policymaking. And most important, it's up to us to defeat those politicians who, because they want to ban abortion or gift their benefactors with tax goodies or start another war in the Middle East, tolerate or facilitate the president's abuses of power. Our next news article, from the Soapboxers column, John Burns is right. The president is a white supremacist. Last week, Wake County Commissioner John Burns caused a controversy by saying something that shouldn't be controversial at all. The President of the United States is a white supremacist. Burns' remarks on Twitter were prompted by President Trump's attacks on the African-American NFL players kneeling for the national anthem, Sons of Buns. A strange contrast to his comments in August that there were some very fine people marching with white nationalists and neo-Nazis in Charlottesville. My main point, Burns says, is that you can't treat American citizens exercising their right to protest worse than you treat mass murderers in your comments when you're president of the United States. After the News and Observer reported on Burns' tweet, he got some angry emails and Facebook comments, though not as many as he expected. In fact, he says, the responses he received were far more positive than negative. In itself, that says something. A public official calling the President of the United States a white supremacist should be a shocking act. But it wasn't. Here it was, a one-day story that most people moved on. If anything, the events of the last week have only made Burns' case for him. To describe Trump's initial reaction to the devastation that Hurricane Maria wrought in Puerto Rico as sluggish or neglectful only skims the surface. We knew where the storm was headed days out. We knew it would be catastrophic. We knew on the day it struck that the island was destroyed, as government officials said. Power was gone. Potable water was nowhere to be found. Streets were impassable. Communications were impossible. Hospitals were shutting down. And yet the president spent that weekend attacking black athletes who are peacefully protesting police violence against black Americans. He uttered barely a word about Puerto Rico as millions of American citizens languished without access to food or water. He didn't call on Americans to send money or supplies. He didn't suspend the Jones Act, as he'd done after similar disasters in Texas and Florida, or dispatch the USNS Comfort, a naval hospital ship, until a week after the storm. By all appearances, he was utterly indifferent. As the Washington Post reported, it wasn't until four full days after Maria's landfall that Trump started to understand the scope of the disaster, and only then when he saw the press criticizing his response. That night he tweeted about Puerto Rico's broken infrastructure and massive debt, as if Puerto Rico was somehow to blame. By Friday, the president was patting himself on the back, telling reporters, "It's been incredible. The results we've had with respect to loss of life. The death toll is officially 16. But as the Miami Herald reported, experts say the real number is far higher, perhaps into the hundreds. Even the lieutenant general Trump put in charge of the mess has admitted the government hasn't committed enough troops or supplies. So, after the mayor of San Juan, who is currently living in a shelter because her home was flooded, pointed out that this wasn't a good news story and that people were dying, Trump attacked her and Puerto Ricans generally. He tweeted from his New Jersey golf club that she showed such poor leadership ability and that Puerto Ricans want everything to be done for them. This is another new low in American politics. Though we've seen many new lows in the last 9 months, you could chalk this one up to Trump being a fragile narcissist. He is. But we're deluding ourselves if we pretend that his casual disregard for the plight of millions of Spanish-speaking American citizens isn't informed by something even more ominous. After all, racism has been a defining aspect of Trump's political ascent, from his propagation of the birther conspiracy theory to his vicious attacks on Muslims and immigrants. Talk all you want about economic insecurity. The fact remains that support for Trump is inextricably linked to white identity. As Duke University political science professor Ashley Giardina wrote for the Washington Post's Monkey Page blog in August, "My own work and that of others has shown that levels of white identity are one of the strongest predictors of Trump's support. White identifiers are more likely to think that the growth of racial or ethnic groups in the United States that are not white is having a negative effect on American culture." We need to call this what it is. Trump is a white supremacist. He's in power because this white supremacism appeals to white people who feel like they're losing as America becomes more diverse. Saying that shouldn't be controversial. Rather, it is a self-evident fact. Turning now to the art section. In dire need of a kidney transplant, Charlie Lowry takes a new look at her life's work. Charlie Lowry is going through a tough season, but she's not about to let it get the best of her. Lowry, the lead vocalist of Local Roots, soul combo Dockwater Rising, makes passionate music that intersects with her activism in standing up for Lumbee and Native American rights. After watching her mother succumb to cancer in November, it's music and being surrounded by her friends and family that's given Lowry the confidence and strength to keep fighting as she continues dialysis necessary to treat an autoimmune disorder that's disrupted her life. Diagnosed with IgA nephropathy at 18, "I wasn't symptomatic and I didn't feel any pain. I had no clue," she remembers. Lowry took medication for the condition, which is also known as Berger's disease, while in college at UNC Chapel Hill. but her kidneys deteriorated to the point where she was on the transplant list by the age 25, a decade earlier than expected. The sudden death of her cousin in 2009 meant a life-saving donation for Lowry, but that organ, too, is now failing. While she awaits a donor, Lowry has gained a renewed energy and focus toward exploring new musical ideas in the absence of her biggest fan, with her sights still set on a Grammy. Mama was my best friend, and I always grieve her loss. But I think in the spring, I'll come out like a butterfly, she said. A question from the indie in this interview. What's involved in your treatment now? Her answer, I moved back to Pembroke a couple of months ago to take care of my mother, who had stage 4 cancer and passed away on November 21st. So I set up my treatment in Pembroke. It's nice to be back home, and that's what's helping me to deal with a lot of my treatments, to be back on the land I was raised on. I've been living in Chapel Hill and commuting back and forth for the past 4 years, coming to Pembroke every 2 weeks or so. Before going on dialysis, I feared it a lot. I didn't want to be hooked up to a machine in order to live. I tried to avoid the conversation whenever the doctor wanted to talk about it, and I was bitter and angry when I first started my treatments. They finally put a catheter in my abdomen for me to do my treatments at home last summer, because they were aware of my schedule as a musician. I performed with another group called Utali Project, and I took all of my supplies over to France for about a week and a half and did my treatments there. I had some flexibility, but it was a lot of work, and it was starting to take its toll on me. I also found out that I had a hole in my diaphragm, so whenever I was doing the treatments from home, fluid was leaking into my right lung. I had just performed at Shikori Hills and ended up going to the hospital the following Monday because fluid had been collecting in my lung. They were amazed that I was still breathing and able to perform, but they said I was able to do that because all the singing had conditioned my lungs to be strong. The next question. How has coping with this condition or the treatment given you a different perspective on life? She answered, I don't remember this fact from going through orientation the first time, but this time they made a point that a kidney transplant is only a temporary solution. It's not a cure. So if I live for a good while, I'm probably have to end up getting another transplant. Being hooked up to the dialysis machine that really puts it into a perspective for me. If something goes wrong, if I get kidnapped and can't get to a machine, I'm gone. I always think about it if I'm living in the 1800s and had this going on. I would have been a goner. My life may have been cut short by all of this, but it is what it is. My mother showed me how to die gracefully, and I'm ready whenever, I guess. I'm just embracing the whole situation and taking it one day at a time. The next question, to what extent has this sense of mortality changed your approach towards either your activism or your music? She commented, I told my friends that I knew I was going to go through a dark period when Mama passed because she was my main motivation. She's the one that has supported me all my musical endeavors and my activism. She was always supportive, always a listening ear. We did a canoe trip down the Lumbar River to raise awareness about the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, and Mama had a fear of water and couldn't swim, but she went on the water with me. Now I don't have her here, so I have gone to revisit how I approach my music. I'm sure some songs are going to come out of my experience. I've even thought about writing a book regarding her illness and my thoughts on her treatment. I think now that she has passed in some weird way, I'm going to be able to buckle down and be more focused. She was my main reason for coming home, So now that she's not here, I'm more apt to travel away for shows and stay gone longer on tour. The time that I dedicated to her, I'm dedicating to my music. I'm very funny about the creative process. I haven't found that it comes easy to me. I'm hoping that having my own space and being able to explore more and create whatever I want will help with that. I was always thinking about Dark Waters Rising before, and now I'm thinking more about my solo career and experimenting with different genres and concepts. I've got a country accent, and I'm from the country, so why not write some country songs and see how they do? I was raised in the church, so I might write some old-timey gospel songs and put them on an album. And our final question, how do you see Dark Water Rising evolving? She said, our lineup has changed, so we're going to be branching out anyway when we create music this next time around. Emily Mosolino is no longer in the band, so we've contemplated adding another member or just keeping it as a four-piece. But either way, it's going to affect the music we create. We've been talking about this third album for 2 or 3 years now. We did an Indiegogo campaign and didn't reach our goal, but we raised a few $1,000s, enough to pay for the recording. We don't have a set release date, but it's 95% done. It's just a matter of going back and fine-tuning it. And now a brief look from the food section. You don't need a storefront to run a popular bakery, but a wood-burning oven helps. Julie Blaine always walked by the same bakery on her way home from work in Barcelona. The streets were shadowed by black skies, but the shop glowed with bakers flickering like fireflies as they prepared the bread she would buy the next day. Julia, who moved to Spain after graduating college, worked as a bartender, and several of her regulars were those midnight bakers at Bar Laurent, the French bakery. As they drank at the bar, she repeatedly asked them for a job, but she wasn't eligible because she didn't speak French, even though we were in Spain, and she laughed at that. Eventually, another French baker did hire her, Lyle Vanamod, at La Farm Bakery in Kerry. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. And a reminder that this broadcast will be available as a podcast following its initial offering. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.